Chapter 6, continued. The wage don't fit. These two proposals equate to the reduction of labor demand through full automation and the reduction of labor supply through the shortening of the working week. The combined outcome of these measures would be the liberation of a significant amount of free time without a reduction in economic output or a significant increase in unemployment. Yet this free time will be of little value if people continue struggling to make ends meet. As Paul Maddock puts it, the leisure of the starving, or the needy, is no leisure at all, but a relentless activity aimed at staying alive or improving their station. The underemployed, for instance, have plenty of free time, but lack the means to enjoy it. Underemployed, it turns out, is really just a euphemism for underwaged. This is why an essential demand in a post-work society is for a universal basic income, UBI, giving every citizen a livable amount of money without any means testing. It is an idea that has periodically popped up throughout history. In the early 1940s, a version of it was advanced as an alternative to the Beveridge Report that eventually shaped the UK welfare state. In a now largely forgotten period during the 1960s and 1970s, the basic income was central to proposals for US welfare reform. Economists, NGOs, and policymakers explored the idea in detail, and a number of small-scale experiments were set up in Canada and the United States. Such was the influence of UBI that over 1,300 economists signed a petition pushing the U.S. Congress to enact, quote, a national system of income guarantee, unquote. Three separate administrations gave serious consideration to the proposal, and two presidents, Nixon and Carter, attempted to pass legislation to achieve it. In other words, UBI very nearly became a reality in the 1970s. While Alaska eventually implemented a basic income funded by its oil wealth, the idea largely disappeared from debate in the wake of neoliberal hegemony. But recent years have seen the idea undergo a resurgence in popularity. In both mainstream and critical media, it has gained traction, being taken up by Paul Krugman, Martin Wolf, The New York Times, The Financial Times, and The Economist. The Swiss are holding a referendum on UBI in 2016. The proposal has been recommended by parliamentary committees in other countries. Various political parties have adopted it in their manifestos, and there have been new experiments with it in Namibia and India. The idea has global scope, having been promoted forcefully by groups in Brazil, South Africa, Italy, and Germany, and by an international network involving over 20 countries. The movement for a UBI is thus once again resurgent in the wake of the 2008 crisis, and the austerity regimes put in place after it. The demand for a UBI, however, is subject to competing hegemonic forces. It is just as open to being mobilized for a libertarian dystopia as for a post-work society, an ambiguity that has led many to mistakenly conflate the two poles. In demanding a UBI, therefore, three key factors must be articulated in order to make it meaningful. It must provide a sufficient amount of income to live on, it must be universal, provided to everyone unconditionally, and it must be a supplement to the welfare state rather than a replacement of it. The first point is obvious enough. A UBI must provide a materially adequate income. The exact amount will vary between countries and regions, but it can be relatively easily arrived at with existing data. The risk is that, if set too low, UBI becomes just a government subsidy to businesses. In addition, UBI must be universal and given to everyone unconditionally. As there would be no means testing or other measures required to receive the UBI, it would break free of the disciplinary nature of welfare capitalism. Moreover, a universal grant avoids the stigmatization of welfare, since everyone receives it. As we argued in Chapter 4, the invocation of universalism, quote-unquote, also obliges the continual subversion of any restricted application of a basic income, in terms of individual status as citizens, immigrants, or prisoners. The demand for universality provides the basis for a continued struggle to expand the scope and scale of the basic income. Lastly, the UBI must be a supplement to the welfare state. The conservative argument for a basic income, which must be avoided at all costs, is that it should simply replace the welfare state by providing a lump sum of money to every individual. In this scenario, the UBI would just become a vector of increased marketization, transforming social services into private markets. Rather than being some aberration of neoliberalism, it would simply extend its essential gesture by creating new markets. By contrast, the demand made here is for UBI as a supplement to a revived welfare state. Drawing upon moral arguments and empirical research, there are a vast number of reasons to support a UBI. Reduced poverty, better public health, and reduced health costs, fewer high school dropouts, reductions in petty crime, more time with family and friends, and less state bureaucracy. Depending on how UBI is presented, it is capable of generating support from across the political spectrum, from libertarians, conservatives, anarchists, Marxists, and feminists, among others. The potency of the demand lies partly in this ambiguity, making it capable of mobilizing broad popular support. However, for our purposes, the significance of a UBI as a demand lies in four key interrelated factors. The first point to emphasize is that the demand for UBI is a demand for a political transformation, not just an economic one. It is often thought that UBI is simply a form of redistribution from the rich to the poor, or that it is just a measure to maintain economic growth by stimulating consumer demand. From this perspective, UBI would have impeccable reformist credentials and be little more than a glorified progressive tax system. Yet the real significance of UBI lies in the way it overturns the asymmetry of power that currently exists between labor and capital. As we saw in the discussion of surplus populations, the proletariat is defined by its separation from the means of production and subsistence. The proletariat is thereby forced to sell itself in the job market in order to gain the income necessary to survive. The most fortunate among us have the leisure to choose which job to take, but few of us have the capacity to choose no job. A basic income changes this condition by giving the proletariat a means of subsistence without dependency on a job. Workers, in other words, have the option to choose whether to take a job or not, in many ways taking neoclassical economics at its word, and making work truly voluntary. A UBI therefore unbinds the coercive aspects of wage labor, partially decommodifies labor, and thus transforms the political relationship between labor and capital. This transformation, making work voluntary rather than coerced, has a number of significant consequences. In the first place, it increases class power by reducing slack in the labor market. Surplus populations show what happens when there are large amounts of slack in the labor market. Wages fall, and employers are free to debase workers. By contrast, when the labor market is tight, labor gains the political edge. The economist Michael Kolecki recognized this long ago when he argued that it explained why full employment would be resisted at every step. If every worker were employed, the threat of being fired would lose its disciplinary character. There would be more than enough jobs waiting just outside. Workers would gain the upper hand, and capital would lose its political power. The same dynamic holds for a basic income. By eliminating the reliance on wage labor, workers gain control over how much labor to supply, giving them significant power in the labor market. Class power is also increased in a variety of other ways. Strikes are easier to mobilize, since workers no longer have to worry about pay being docked or dwindling strike funds. The amount of time spent working for a wage can be modified to one's own desire, with free time being spent building communities and engaging with politics. One can slow down and reflect, safely protected from the constant pressures of neoliberalism. The anxieties that surround work and unemployment are reduced with the safety net of a UBI. Moreover, the demand for UBI combines the needs of the employed, the unemployed, and the underemployed, migrant labor, temporary workers, students, and the disabled. It articulates a common interest between these groups and provides a populist orientation for them to mobilize towards. The second related feature of UBI is that it transforms precarity and unemployment from a state of insecurity to a state of voluntary flexibility. It is often forgotten that the initial push for flexible labor came from workers, as a way of demolishing the constraining permanency of traditional Fordist labor. The repetitiveness of a 9-to-5 job, combined with the tediousness of most work, is hardly an appealing prospect for a lifelong career. The demands of care labor often require a flexible approach as well, further undermining the appeal of traditional jobs. Marx himself invokes the liberating aspects of flexible labor in his famous claim that communism, quote, makes it possible for me to do one thing today and another tomorrow, to hunt in the morning, fish in the afternoon, rear cattle in the evening, criticize after dinner, just as I have a mind, without ever becoming a hunter, fisherman, herdsman, or critic. Unquote. In the face of these desires for flexibility, capital adapted and co-opted them into a new form of exploitation. Today, flexible labor simply presents itself as precarity and insecurity rather than freedom. The UBI responds to this generalization of precarity and transforms it from a state to be feared back into a state of liberation. Third, a basic income would necessitate a rethinking of the values attributed to different types of work. Given that workers would no longer be forced to take a job, they could instead simply reject jobs that paid too little, required too much work, offered too few benefits, or demeaning and undignified. Low-waged work is often crass and disempowering, and under a program of UBI, it is unlikely that many would want to undertake it. The result would be that hazardous, boring, and unattractive work would have to be better paid, while more rewarding, invigorating, and attractive work would be less well paid. In other words, the nature of work would become a measure of its value, not merely its profitability. The outcome of this revaluation would also mean that, as wages for the worst jobs rose, there would be new incentives to automate them. UBI therefore forms a positive feedback loop with the demand for full automation. On the other hand, a basic income would not only transform the value of the worst jobs, but also go some way towards recognizing the unpaid labor of most care work. In the same way that the demand for wages for housework recognized and politicized the domestic labor of women, so too does UBI recognize and politicize the generalized way in which we are all responsible for reproducing society. From informal to formal work, from domestic to public work, from individual to collective work, what is central is not productive labor, defined in either traditional Marxist or neoclassical terms, but rather the more general category of reproductive labor. Given that we all contribute to the production and reproduction of capitalism, our activity deserves to be remunerated as well. In recognizing this, the UBI indicates a shift from a remuneration based upon ability to remuneration based upon basic need. All the genetic, historical, and social variations that make effort a poor measure of a person's worth are rejected here, and instead people are valued simply for being people. Finally, a basic income is a fundamentally feminist proposal. Its disregard for the gendered division of labor overcomes some of the biases of the traditional welfare state predicated upon a male breadwinner. Equally, it recognizes the contributions of unwaged domestic laborers to the reproduction of society and provides them with an income accordingly. The financial independence that comes with a basic income is also crucial to developing the synthetic freedom of women. It enables experimentation with different forms of family and community structure that are no longer bound to the model of the privatized nuclear family. And financial independence can reconfigure intimate relationships as well. One of the more unexpected findings of experiments with UBI has been that the divorce rate tended to rise. Conservative commentators jumped on this as proof of the demand's immorality. But higher divorce rates are easily explained as women gaining the financial means to leave dysfunctional relationships. A basic income can therefore enable easier experimentation with the family structure, more possibilities for the provision of childcare, and an easier transformation of the gendered division of labor. Moreover, unlike the demand for, quote, wages for housework, unquote, in the 1970s, the demand for UBI promises to break out of the wage relation rather than reinforce it. While a universal basic income may appear economically reformist, its political implications are therefore significant. It transforms precarity. It recognizes social labor. It makes class power easier to mobilize. And it extends the space in which to experiment with how we organize communities and families. It is a redistribution mechanism that transforms production relations. It is an economic mechanism that changes the politics of work. And in terms of class struggle, there is little to distinguish full employment from full unemployment. Both tighten the labor market, give power to labor, and make it more difficult to exploit workers. Full unemployment has the added advantages of not being reliant upon the gendered division of labor between the household and the formal economy, of not keeping workers chained to the wage relation, and of allowing workers autonomy over their lives. For all of these reasons, the classical social democratic demand for full employment should be replaced with the future-oriented demand for full unemployment.